You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Happy Friday. I'm Miles O'Brien in for Leonard Lopate today. Sarah Palin is our topic at the outset of the program today. To say she has an unprecedented style of conducting political business almost seems like an understatement. She communicates directly with the public through Facebook and Twitter, and yet she's very secretive when it comes to dealing with people who are members of the so-called mainstream media. Michael Joseph Gross followed Palin's road for 4 months, talking to as many people as he could, not including Sarah Palin. We'll ask him about that. And the product of all that is an article in the October issue of Vanity Fair called The Sound and the Fury. Welcome to the program. Good to have you with us, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Miles.
All right. It's a fascinating tale. First of all, tell us, what was the biggest surprise for you? Any sort of preconceived notion you had about Sarah Palin that was different in reality, or was there something you just stumbled upon that you wouldn't have predicted?
I have a lot in common with Sarah Palin. I'm a small-town person. I'm a Christian. I had the idea, even though our politics are quite different, that she had probably gotten a bum steer by the press. I thought that there was, I think there's a lot to some of the criticisms she makes of the elite liberal media. So I set out really with a prejudice in her favor and trying to give her the benefit of the doubt in every case.
The term would be leaning forward for Sarah Palin then.
Exactly. Okay. I was really surprised then to begin to hear accounts of a character that is so much at odds with the public image that she's putting out there that at first I didn't believe the stories I was hearing about temper tantrums, about the most horrific kind of abuse, about the angriest behavior toward people you can imagine. Then I began to hear the same stories from people who'd known her 10 years earlier and thousands of miles away. And gradually, I came to see that this is the real person. So I was really shocked by that.
So to boil your story down to one point would be the public Palin is not at all connected to the private Palin. Is that what you conclude?
I think that's right.
So give us a sense, first of all, you weren't able to speak with her. She doesn't talk to typical mainstream media outlets, right? I mean, if you call her up, if you're not from Fox News, what's the answer?
The answer is usually nothing. You just send the inquiry out there into the void. I would get an occasional email back saying that my request was under consideration, but it never got beyond that. And I tried everything. I went to her beauty parlor one day while she was there, and I left a note with her hairdresser. I left a letter with her father, but nothing worked.
You even went to the beauty parlor and whatever you could do. Now, but, you know, conventionally, a conventional politician, you call up the press secretary or the media person, the communications person, and you get put in the queue and all that sort of thing. That doesn't happen in this case?
No, it doesn't happen unless you, I think, can be relied on to write a, you know, what they would call a positive story.
But that's interesting because you say, hey, I'm a conservative guy. I'm a Christian. I want to believe in Palin. And I assume you imparted that you were coming at it that way. That wasn't enough.
Nothing I said seemed to make any difference.
So the fact that you were with Vanity Fair, a presumed liberal mainstream media outlet, was enough. No interview granted.
That may have been it. I can't read their minds.
Okay, so that left you with following her around, listening to her speeches, and talking to as many people in her circle, as tight as you could get, as possible. How much luck did you have doing that?
A lot more than I expected. There are a lot of people who have had very disturbing interactions with Sarah Palin who have been aghast to see her rise over the last year and a half to the position of influence that she's in. And they think it's important that the truth about her get out there.
But they're very reluctant to say so on the record. Tell us about that.
Sarah Palin is the most powerful person in a very small and geographically isolated community. I think that's the one fact about her that very few of us have been able to get through our skulls. The population of all of Alaska is less than, if I remember correctly, the populations of El Paso or of Providence, Rhode Island. So if you cross this person, you have no place to go.
So when you approach people, give us a flavor of how a conversation like that went.
Parking lot, Walmart, Wasilla, Alaska. Walk up. I'm here from New York City, writing a story for Vanity Fair about Sarah Palin. Wonder, would you have a minute to talk to me? Off the record, is the response. It was like the whole town had had media training. It was like the whole town was sort of cowering in fear of having an open and honest conversation about Sarah.
How much of that do you suppose is people protecting Palin, or conversely and related, afraid to cross her? And how much of that would you attribute to, you know, the typical Alaska suspicion of the lower 48, in particular, a New York media person?
Well, in most cases, and I didn't answer your question fully because I didn't tell you the rest of the story. In most cases, after I would say, off the record, there would be a sort of kabuki dance where certain questions would be asked to try to feel me out. When they eventually found out that I was coming in peace, they felt comfortable talking. And the more they talked, the more fruit came falling from the tree. The more they talked, the more they were willing to tell me what she was really like. And that picture always faded down darker and darker the longer the conversation went.
Darker and darker. The term I think you use is sad and moldering. That is her real world. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that even though we're in a time in American politics that is arguably as polarized as it's been in the last 50 years, she stands out as being the only mainstream contemporary politician who has intentionally cultivated an atmosphere of intimidation around her. She is the only person who has a sort of designated gang of people on the web who go after anybody who dares to criticize her in any way, calling them liar, creep, stormtrooper, scumbag, the latter of which has become the prefix to my name on the website called Conservatives for Palin lately. It's really worth a look.
Yeah, it's is it a strategy that she has long practiced, or is this something that happened as a direct outgrowth of the run for the Oval Office along with John McCain?
There have been dirty tricks going all the way back to her first race for mayor, as a number of people have reported for the last 2 years. But certainly after the election, I think something snapped in Sarah. One person who visited her house shortly after the loss witnessed a meltdown where Sarah said to one of her children, "We're not good enough for America. We'll never be good enough for America." To me, that was probably the most revealing bit of secondhand dialogue that I heard in the whole process of reporting this story. I think that there was a wound to the ego there that she is seeking vengeance for any way she can.
I'm speaking with Vanity Fair writer Michael Joseph Gross. We're talking about his article in the October issue of the magazine, Sarah Palin's Sound and Fury. What you just related was, in a court of law, they'd call that hearsay, Your Honor. Tell me about how comfortable you are about whether these conversations are true and how you were able to verify and double-check things.
It's a really good question, and it was a really hard situation because what Sarah has done is she's put the press into an impossible situation. She sends out this one-way stream of information on Twitter and on Facebook and doesn't make herself available for the kind of give and take, the kind of conversational interaction that we usually expect from politicians. So the press is put in the situation of either reporting what she says exactly as she said it in this very controlled way, or saying saying nothing at all about her.
I guess, from her perspective, it's brilliant.
It is. But that meant that because there was this reluctance to speak on the record, I had to make a very cautious, very careful decision about who I was going to listen to and who I was going to trust. I got to know my sources very well over periods of weeks or months and many hours of conversations. When I encountered somebody who was clearly speaking from an agenda to discredit or attack Sarah Palin, I would listen to what they had to say, draw a line through those pages in my notebook. Everything that's in this article comes from people who were speaking reluctantly, people who were afraid, but who were willing to reckon with that fear and overcome it to try to get the information out there, even though they weren't willing to risk their reputations and their livelihoods by putting their names on it at this point.
The picture you paint is a person who, I guess at best you could say mercurial, but at worst you might say is unstable. And there's a lot of talk here about her temper. Give us some anecdotes that you uncovered about that.
This is one of the places where relying on anonymous sources becomes very difficult, because most of the specific stories that I heard are easily traceable. As I'm talking, I'm recalling one that I was able to put in the story. It's about it comes from a person who was a frequent house guest of the Palins and was a friend of theirs for many years. She recalled an occasion where Todd and Sarah were fighting, as they often did, and decided to empty the pantry of canned goods, which they threw at one another. As the story went, by the end of the fight, the front of the stainless steel refrigerator looked like it had gotten shot up by a shotgun.
That's a pretty serious fight that you describe. So is her temper? Let's back up. What about the relationship with her husband, the first dude, as she describes him? There were rumors there for a little while that a divorce was looming. Were you able to get the true story on that one?
Well, according to the friends of the Palins that I talked to, it is something that they discussed at length and fought a lot about. As we're getting into this territory, I'd really like to just take a moment to say something that I think is important about the context in which we discuss Sarah Palin's personal life and her family life, especially her life as a wife and a mother. I am always reluctant to go there, shall we say. But in this case, I felt like this kind of intimate detail was important for the public to know, because Sarah Palin is putting herself forward as a political leader, not on the basis of policy positions, not on the basis of any kind of information that she's offering, but on the sole basis of her identity, who she is. Look at the Mama Grizzlies video. She talks about the country being on the verge of a mom revolution. She says, moms just kind of know stuff. I think given that, who she is as a wife and mother, these details of her domestic life become fair game and become important things for us to look at. So I just wanted to say that before we get any further into the personal stuff.
My guest is Vanity Fair writer Michael Joseph Gross. We're discussing his article in the October issue of the magazine, Sarah Palin, Sound and Fury, is it's what it is called. You can find a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. We're going to take a short break. Please stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Leonard Lopate on this Friday. I'm speaking with Vanity Fair writer Michael Joseph Gross. He's out with an article in the October edition of that magazine, Sarah Palin, Sound and Fury. You can find a link to it on our site. And, of course, if you want to pick up the magazine, I'm sure that the folks at Vanity Fair would be happy if you did that. It's a tough business. Speaking of, Sarah Palin, you talk about her strategy, her political strategy. And, you know, I was thinking about how she is in some respects a latter-day version of Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan used to say, let's bypass the Beltway media, and he'd go and do local events with local media. There was no Twitter back then, but I suspect they probably would have employed it. In her case, she's able to tweet and completely bypass mainstream media as we know it. And to the extent that she uses what would be called mainstream media, it's the partisan media, in this case, Fox News. Now, just the other night, she was on O'Reilly after the success of Christine O'Donnell winning the Republican primary in Delaware. And she offered up some advice to Christine O'Donnell. Let's listen for just a moment.
She's going to have to learn that. Yeah, very quickly. She's going to have to dismiss that. Go with her gut. Get out there. Speak to the American people. Speak through Fox News and let the independents who are tuning into you, let them know what it is that she stands for, the principles behind her positions.
Go with her gut. Speak to the American people directly. Use Fox News. That kind of sums up her strategy in a nutshell, doesn't it?
I guess so.
Yeah. Is this something? Is she arrived at some secret sauce for politics in the 21st century?
Well, I think going back to what we were saying earlier, this setup that she's created, where she has exempted herself from the rules of the game that we expect everybody else to play by, is something that people like us, people in the media, need to be taking a really close look at. I, for the life of me, don't understand why we continue to give her a pass, even when she's shown that she's willing to lie about anything from policy, as when she completely fabricated the idea of death panels and sent the country off on a crazy tangent in the healthcare debate, to the details of her personal life. This is somebody whose information is not rooted in facts, and yet we continue to report it slavishly.
Well, and of course, death panels was something that she included in a Facebook post. That's how that was brought out there. All right. So, but to what extent, though, is this you as a representative of the mainstream media peeling, a little bit of sour grapes here? You're not a part of the mix anymore. She's found another way to communicate with the American people. More power to her.
I don't actually feel that at all as sour grapes. I feel like the press plays a really important part in American democracy, and I think most people agree with that. The press acts as a surrogate for the citizenry. We ask the questions that people can't ask directly, and it's not as if people are, having direct conversations with her on Twitter and Facebook. They're just hearing the stream of propaganda that she or, really her people are sending out.
Sophie from Poughkeepsie writes on our show page, more and more politicians are increasingly not making themselves available and by not debating and or granting in-depth interviews or just refusing to answer questions. So this is part of a trend, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure. I think we would need to do some statistical analysis to see what kind of a trend is there. I know people have criticized the president for having fewer press conferences than his predecessors, but he has had more sit-down, one-on-one interviews with reporters than his predecessors have. I know that increasing numbers of congressmen, senators, governors are availing themselves of new media, but I don't think anybody is leaning on it to the extent that Sarah Palin is.
I'm speaking with Michael Joseph Gross. He is a writer for Vanity Fair magazine, and we're talking about his article on Sarah Palin, The Sound and the Fury, in the October edition of that magazine. The criticism you could have predicted and was as... it gets pretty vituperative, doesn't it? It gets ugly out there very quickly. Were you ready for that?
I was ready for some of it. I was ready for Palin's strongest partisans to come at me with all their guns out. But what I wasn't prepared for was actually some of the behavior of the mainstream media. I was very surprised when the Associated Press ran with a story containing an allegation of fabrication without even asking me for comment. I was very surprised at some of the remarks from, I guess, representatives of publications that seemed more designed to get attention and links to their blogs than like constructive elements of a debate over the facts in the story.
I think we might be in the post-constructive world here. What do you think? I don't know. But what is, if you could help people, there was a part of the article that was you made a mistake about identifying a Down syndrome child that was not hers, Trigg. It was another Down syndrome child. Is that what you're talking about in the AP piece?
That's right. I was at a rally in Independence, Missouri, a Tea Party rally, where I sat in the bleachers in a place where I could observe what happened both in front of the stage and behind the scenes. And I saw the Palin family with a Down syndrome baby who, because the next day in Wichita, I saw them walking into their hotel with a Down syndrome baby, I assumed was the same Down syndrome baby and was Trigg in a way that didn't even feel like an assumption. But as it turns out, there's a woman in St. Louis, a radio talk show host on a Christian station and a public relations consultant who says that the baby I saw in Independence was not Trigg, it was her son. However, and I'll take her word on that. However, she went on to say that it couldn't have been an honest mistake because I had interviewed her and she had told me that this was her son. And at that point, I couldn't believe my eyes because I had never heard of this woman before. I had never spoken with her. I'd never communicated with her in any way.
No chance there would be some other person you might have talked to and not made the connection? Or do you think this was just spun from whole cloth?
Well, to give her the benefit of the doubt, it's possible that she spoke with another reporter that day, although I have subsequently tried to find out whether any reporters were allowed backstage where they would have been able to talk to her, and none of the reporters in Kansas City who were there were allowed backstage. So it's possible there was some other, reporter along with the Palins. But certainly if she's claiming that she talked to a Vanity Fair reporter, then that is a fabrication.
Now, you mentioned a while ago, this notion of getting inside Palin's personal life, and you feel that's fair game. And in the case of public officials, I'll take your case on that. Your point is well made. There is a point in the article where I felt like maybe there was a line crossed when you were talking about the tipping issue. There was this, you had spoken to some bellboys at a hotel where she had, or bellman, where she had checked in, and they were complaining about the fact that she's the worst tipper of anybody famous who's been through there and how the chambermaids were not tipped as well. Is that fair game? Is that relevant? The critics would call that a cheap shot.
I would always go back to looking at the context of who Sarah is presenting herself to be. Sarah is on the road saying that she is standing up for normal, average, everyday, hardworking Americans, and she's claiming to be one herself. And yet, she doesn't treat normal, average, everyday, hardworking Americans very well. The people who make her life possible, without exception, have suffered, again, the most horrific abuse. The stories of how she's treated her own personal assistants, going all the way back to her time as mayor of Wasilla, begin this pattern, which then is replicated in a much smaller way, but a way that I feel is still relevant, as she is traveling around the country and stiffing, the people who are working incredibly hard to get her bags to her room, to keep her room clean. Anybody with just a basic sense of manners and decency knows that that's worth a little something.
So as you traveled and you got a sense of what she was all about, unfortunately, without having the opportunity to speak with her, did you find any insights on the phenomenon, what it is that resonates with people about her message?
I'd like to go back to the moment in her house where, after the election, she says we weren't good enough for America. I think there are a whole lot of people in this country who feel like there's another class of people who think that they're not good enough. I think people who grow up in places where nothing that has to do with them, nothing that's a part of their life has ever been on TV, has ever been in the movies. I think those people live in a way that makes them feel isolated from the world of meaning. Wasilla is a place like that. And I think Sarah is plugging into that feeling of alienation in her speeches. One of the boilerplate lines is, they think we don't understand their policies and they talk down to us, especially here in the heartland. But I'm here to, you know, tell them that we do understand, and you're not going to tell us to sit down and shut up. Now, to a lot of people, I think that is feeling like affirmation, but I wonder if it really is. I wonder if instead it's planting seeds of self-doubt in people. I wonder if it's stoking this fire that says, maybe I really am not good enough.
And the people who follow her can be supporters. In politics, people get revved up about their candidates, but it seems like this goes to 11, to use the Spinal Tap term in some respects. And the people who blog on her behalf, there's somebody you spoke with, as a matter of fact, who had volunteered for Obama at one point and ultimately became a popular pro-Palin blogger. It's almost like there is a sense of mission there that other politicians don't get. Is that right?
First, I just want to correct. I did not actually speak with that person whose name is Rebecca Mansour, but I would like to get back to her in a second.
You wrote about her, any case.
That's right. There's another quote in the story from a member of this, or a contributor to this website, Conservatives for Palin, who says, we would literally walk on hot, broken glass for this woman. It's like the mafia.
Is it like the mafia?
That's her. That's her analogy.
What do you think?
In a figurative sense, I think that she's describing her experience. She's making this analogy, and I think that we have to take that at her word. But Rebecca Mansour is a really good example. Rebecca Mansour, who, as you said, originally volunteered for Obama, got disillusioned, and then helped start this primary pro-Palin blog called Conservatives for Palin. She really engineered a kind of vitriolic, psychological warfare on this website that appealed to Palin enough that she hired the woman. Now, she has no previous political experience at all. And now, according to the Daily Beast, I believe yesterday, Mansour is considered her closest aide. This is a person who on her personal Twitter feed, calls the vice president an asshat. There's no line, it seems, that she won't cross.
So let's talk about the inner circle then. Who's there? And you mentioned that the people who attain this inner circle status are not treated so well. That's what your reporting has indicated. What happens to these people as they get closer and closer to Sarah Palin?
Well, in the past, the current inner circle, first of all, consists of Mansour, who much circumstantial evidence suggests that Mansour is actually the person who's writing Sarah's Twitter and Facebook messages. The facts that suggest that are lined up in the article. A man named Randy Schoeneman, who is a lobbyist and a key member of the neoconservative foreign policy establishment, I guess, and a former lobbyist for British Petroleum and for a number of foreign governments, as Jeffrey Dunn has pointed out. Randy Shuneman is helping her with foreign policy. A person named Kim Stanley, who's a lawyer with the Thomas More Center, a right-wing think tank that is devoted to trying to put forward Christian public policy initiatives to turn our country back into a Christian nation. Kim is the domestic policy advisor. And then there are a couple of guys who were advance men during the campaign who help her run things day to day and serve as her sort of confidants. Their names are Jason Recher, who developed a real reputation in the 2008 campaign for insubordination and for indulging her whims. At one point, after the campaign had decided to give up on Michigan, Recher and Palin hatched a plan to take off and do a rogue trip into Michigan. Secret Service found out what was going on, asked the campaign what they should do, and the answer came back, shoot out the tires.
So he's the guy, the brainchild of going rogue.
And, perhaps.
Yeah.
Those are some of the main insiders right now. Oh, and Timothy Crawford, of course, who is her treasurer, who's currently under investigation by the Ohio Secretary of State for some financial irregularities regarding a straw man out-of-state organization that was set up on a ballot initiative there. None of these people, all of these people are folks who've come into her life just over the past 2 years. There's nobody in her organization, other than Todd and her parents, who are still very close advisors to her, I think. Nobody in the organization who goes back further than that.
So net, bottom line here, is Sarah Palin, her philosophy, her strategy, her approach to doing politics a template for future candidates, or is it going to be ultimately an asterisk?
It depends so much on, again, what the media does from here on out, how we decide to cover her. I hope that some of the facts in this article will help tip things a little bit toward the media beginning to be tougher on her again, to the media beginning to see her as something other than a meal ticket, which I think is how we see her. There's a rule of thumb in the publishing industry right now that if you just put her name in a headline, it's good for 100,000 hits automatically. And at a time when newsrooms don't have enough money for almost anything, just having a crazy tweet from Sarah is an easy way to fill space and get traffic without having to put any work into it. But we need to think pretty carefully before we keep going down this road, because that way madness lies.
Thank you very much for coming on the show today. My guest has been Vanity Fair writer Michael Joseph Gross. His article, Sarah Palin's Sound and Fury, is available in the October issue of Vanity Fair and through a link on our show page as well. Michael, thank you again, and let's hope that the mainstream media in all respects continues to do its job.